OT After Dark is a podcast run by two occupational therapists and is for adults only. We believe that sex and sexual pleasure are a human right for consenting adults, regardless of ability, age, gender, or sexual orientation. We discuss topics that cover a wide variety of intimacy and sexual practices. To be true to our strong views regarding inclusivity, we use common and slang terms regarding sexual topics, which may be considered explicit. Listener discretion is advised.
We have exciting news to share. We recently partnered with DirectRec, a free app for OT practitioners, PT practitioners, and speech-language pathologists.
DirectRec helps clinicians to find peer-vetted products, and we recently have added our own recommendations of products on DirectRec for sexual health and wellness.
We helped DirectRec get a little extra sexy. DirectRec helps clinicians share products and other digital info, like YouTube videos and Google Docs, with their clients.
DirectRec helps you to track clients' follow-through on your product recommendations. So to start using DirectRec, click on the link on our website at otafterdark.com or in our social media bios.
I'm Kay.
And I'm JJ.
And we're two occupational therapists.
And we're here talking to you about sex.
We're back!
Woo-woo!
Word on the podcast street is there's a big gaping hole in our absence.
And we're back and we're here to fill that gaping hole with some talk about sex.
Today, we're very pleased to talk to who I always refer to as OT Kate.
Same here. That's how I know her.
That's how social media works. You talked about people by their Instagram name. But OT Kate, also known as Kate Burke, talked to us about implicit model.
Mm-hmm. We also talked about a couple other models to really, you know, how the fuck do we talk about sex?
This is where
this podcast has been going. Well, we found some models for you to kind of help describe, well, here's how we do it and here's what we say.
How you can actually apply it to practice.
Step by step.
And as
Ooh,
usual.
Baby. Sorry, I had to do.
KOTB for life, is that what's happening here? All right. On that note, we're back. We have mimosas in hand. And listen to our very fun conversation with OT Kate.
All right. We are here on OT After Dark with Kate Burke, or as we know her as OT Kate from Instagram.
That's how it works in social media. You know people by their handles.
Yep.
That's right.
Right? So we first met her on Instagram, followed your work. Then we actually got to meet you in real life at the American Occupational Therapy Association conference in New Orleans, where you did some presentations.
We had a little party in the poster session.
Yes. I know, that was awesome. So much fun to meet people at conference.
It is. It's exciting.
Yeah.
So the people, especially for listeners that aren't active on social media, there's an amazing OT social media presence, a welcoming, beautiful social media presence for OT.
That is so true. And that, as you said, that caught me by surprise. I sort of stumbled into it kind of by accident, and it's really impressive the number of therapists who are active, particularly say on Instagram, and are, you know, sharing research they're doing, sharing research they're reading. All kinds of networking, entrepreneurial stuff. It's really a neat way to connect with people that are kind of get excited about the same things that you get excited about that obviously don't necessarily live in your geographic area. Kind of how we found each other.
Yeah. We were blown away when we started our social media accounts. It was literally like 24 hours after we decided to do the podcast, and we were just establishing them just to get them established and weren't expecting any attention because we were far from doing our first podcast, and we were getting all of these like comments and followers, and it was crazy. It was wild.
Yeah.
It's a happy place.
And I've met some really innovative and exciting therapists that way. And then obviously it was really cool to go to, you know, to go to a conference and be able to meet people in real life that you've been, you know, communicating with maybe for a year or so. And I also think it's fantastic for students. Like a lot of the accounts now that I'm following and are following me are occupational therapy students. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really neat way for students to be able to network with established clinicians. Mm-hmm. And maybe ones that, you know, aren't grading their assignments, for example. You know, like there's like a different, it's a different type of relationship. And it's really a really easy way to do professional networking. Whereas, mm-hmm. like, I can't go to a conference every weekend. I can't, you know, get on an airplane every 4 months to go to some, you know, AOTA event. Yeah. But you can be in contact with other clinicians daily and see what people are doing. I notice it's a way to kind of observe trends in the profession. And then even I see people doing like journal clubs and stuff that are like Instagram based. And I'm like, that's such a great idea. I wouldn't have thought necessarily that I'd be going to Instagram for evidence-based practice, you know, information, but
there
sometimes a lot easier than, you know, trying to sift through databases. So
it's also amazing because it's worldwide. So it's like, where else are you going to connect with occupational therapy practitioners from literally all over the world?
And it's interesting to see how what they are focused on is different, and how obviously the healthcare systems are different. And
oh my goodness, so different.
That's another whole podcast.
Yeah,
it's a whole different episode.
Yes, it's several episodes probably.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you think we brought you on OT After Dark?
Okay. So the short version is that probably 4 or so years ago, I was working on my NBCOT recertification. So for people that aren't familiar, that's the national board that we as occupational therapists have to be certified with. And they require you to do a certain amount of continuing education every 3 years to stay certified. So one of the things that I chose to do was this self-assessment. And somewhere in that process, I had this sort of eureka moment, which was that I have a fair amount of comfort talking about sexuality topics, both personally and professionally. And I've been a therapist for, at that time, 15 or so years. And it kind of hit me that I really wasn't doing a good job of helping my clients in that area. It just kind of seemed like it didn't really get addressed. And I wasn't doing it. And I knew that other clinicians and nurses around me weren't doing it. I was working mostly in skilled nursing at that time and had seen some situations that clearly called for someone to address those issues. And it kind of hit me that, wow, that really probably needs to happen more. And so then what I ended up doing is I started playing around with this idea in my head that maybe the world needs an OT that will talk about sex with people, particularly older people, because my primary experience is in geriatrics. Obviously, when we're talking about sexuality issues, that covers a really wide range of ages. But I, in particular, was kind of interested in whether I might be able to help older adults. And so to kind of test out my theory, I started working with a local network marketing company called Athena's that specializes in adult novelty items, basically adaptive equipment, in my opinion. Uh-huh. And I kind of used my role as a distributor with this company to try to, you know, generate some conversations, get myself in front of some audiences and sort of play around with this idea that there might be a need for this. And I think there was a voice in my head that was like, people are going to think you're crazy. Why are you doing this? And what actually happened was the complete opposite, mm-hmm. was that a whole bunch of people started saying, oh my gosh, yes, like you're onto something, like do more of this, talk more about this. And so I ended up connecting with the woman who is the director of our local occupational therapy assistant program. I live in southeastern Massachusetts, and we have a community college in the next town over that has a fantastic CODA program and a very open-minded program director, and I reached out to her, and basically she said, would you put something together and come present at our SIG meeting. SIG is special interest group, which is something that kind of happens in occupational therapy circles where groups kind of get together and present information on different topics. So BCC, which is the community college near me, hosts one of these, and they, she basically invited me to come and speak. So I basically put together a presentation based on the Plissett model, because I thought it's a fairly simple way of kind of introducing sexuality topics, both introducing the idea to clinicians and then giving clinicians some tools for how to introduce it to their clients. And so I did this presentation at this SIG group, which ultimately ended up being a lot of OT assistant students. And the feedback was incredible. People were like, this is awesome. We want more of this. Tell us more. Tell us more. And then Johanna, who's the director, basically started nudging me. And she's like, you need to present this. And then I was like, oh, man. I was like, oh, man, now I've gotten myself into something. But it's actually been really fantastic because it's kind of started all these other little fires. It's kind of part of what said to me, like, this is the time to go back and get your doctorate. Mm-hmm. And it's opened up a few different interesting opportunities. So she kind of nudged me, and that led me to presenting at the Massachusetts conference. And then one of my favorite professors from college happened to be in the audience, and she came up to me after, and she's like, you need to submit this to nationals. And I was like, that's just crazy talk. But I did it anyway, because I figured, what's the worst that can happen, right? The worst that can happen is they say no thank you. And that's not what happened. It was accepted as a poster. And so I presented, like you ladies said, and that's where we met. We had met, obviously, online before that. But you guys showed up at my poster, as well as Catherine, who I feel like is another therapist who's kind of trying to bang this drum along with us and doing some really awesome stuff. So basically what ends up happening in a poster presentation is I got to talk to tons of people. I don't even know how many. I think I talked for 2 hours.
You had a popular poster.
I did. Every time I looked up, there were like people standing there. But it really, what it said to me was, this is a topic that students and clinicians are interested in. And it's interesting, in the article that I imagine you guys are going to reference about the recognition model, it's this thing where people are saying it's important, and then people kind of get paralyzed. And it's like, well, I think it's important to address with clients, but I don't really know how to do that.
And then it's
sort of like it gets lost. It doesn't get any further than that. So really my hope in having this conversation about the Plissett model, and now I feel like I might be leaving my relationship with the Plissett model and developing one with this recognition model that I love.
We have the same thing going on.
Yeah, it's just like, how do we start this conversation? And how do we, how do we help clinicians identify that you don't really need special skills for this? It's really the same stuff that we do as occupational therapists anyway. I personally think it's more awkward to toilet with people than to have a conversation about intimacy. And we toilet people all the time. I've had people say that to me, isn't it awkward to talk to people about sex? And I'm like, isn't it awkward to like take people to the bathroom before you've even had coffee?
Yeah. Before you've even met them, like, hi, nice to meet you. Oh, you have to go take a shit? Okay.
Right. Like, hi, we've never met. I don't even know your name, but you should like take off like all of your lower body clothing and like have a bowel movement in front of me.
Yeah.
Like, right. I mean, we as OTs, we do awkward all the time. I mean, that's kind of, part of our specialty is, right, getting into the nitty gritty, like daily life is awkward, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's kind of what we do. But I think it's, the clinicians and the OT students that I speak to in general don't have a lot of confidence in addressing sexuality topics. And so I think things like the Plissett model, the explicit model, and the recognition model start to kind of give us a way to break it down. It's realize that it's not super scary. It doesn't have to be you know, something that's like really uncomfortable. It's just like, let's put it out there so that our clients know that that's something that we can help them with. So it's been kind of an interesting adventure. So I'm excited now to have met like you ladies and some other people that are doing this and kind of figuring out like what, you know, what happens next. And it's such a cool topic because you can go in so many different directions.
It's a nice, it's a small little group of us now. I'm hoping it gets to be a nice big group of people.
Yes, and I'm hopeful that that's going to happen. I wasn't actually, you know, able to like take down statistics, but I would say probably 80% maybe of the people that I spoke to at my poster were students.
Yes, and that's what we got a lot of.
Yeah, and I tried to ask like, are you a student? Are you a clinician? Are you know? Are you teaching? And I lots of students. And then I would ask the students, does sexuality get covered in your academic program? And I would say at least 75% said no. Like really not at all. Or if it was, it was like a very small, you know, it was a very small amount. It was like kind of mentioned in some other class or kind of brushed over. One student, I don't remember the school, told me that it really wasn't covered at all until their final semester, which I mean, I know in my final semester of my undergrad, I could barely remember anything. I was just trying to survive. So, I mean, it's not prioritized, obviously, in academia yet, which I feel like is a great opportunity for us.
And even at conference, I was in, Catherine Ellis had a Conversations That Matter about academia addressing this. And there was a faculty member there who was saying that it's hurt her career to talk about it. Like,
wow.
Yeah, I know. The schools that she was at, it was she got like bad reviews and it was a bad thing. Thankfully, I'm having the opposite experience in my career. Yeah. But so implicit model. We've referred to it.
And then, you know, got me thinking, how many people really actually know what we're talking about
and when like, we reference it? We were just talking earlier this morning. I vividly remember being taught the implicit model when I was in my OT program, which was 17, 18 years ago. And you don't.
I don't. And we went to the same program with the same professor. And I am sure that it was probably talked about, but it is not in my memory bank.
So I remember.
Yeah, I would have to say, I don't recall. I mean, I was in OT school 20 plus years ago. And I don't recall really learning the implicit model at all. I mostly discovered the implicit model when I started doing research for this for the paper that, or the presentation that I did at the community college.
I put a little question to Twitter last night and the implicit model's not doing so well. I just asked, are you familiar with implicit or explicit? And 71% said they never heard of it. 5% wow. The teacher mentioned it. 17% said, I know the basics. And 7% said very familiar, but I'm one of those very familiar folks. So
I did that skews the data.
But the vast majority hadn't heard of it. I put another poll on Twitter, on Instagram. That's a harder one because I could only do the yes or no. And most people had at least heard of it, but still a lot hadn't heard of it. Mm-hmm. So let's talk implicit. Let's start with implicit.
Kate.
Yes. All right.
Tell us about the implicit model.
All right. I could like talk about the implicit model in my sleep. All right. So the implicit model is basically, so it's an acronym. I don't have visual aids on a podcast, so I'll have to use descriptive language. So the implicit model is this idea of that we provide permission. That's the P. And then the LI refers to limited information. And then SS is specific suggestions. And then IT stands for intensive therapy. So the implicit model basically says that we as clinicians give clients or service users permission to address sexuality topics in the course of treatment. And that's often things like saying, you know, during an eval, you know, occupational therapy's role is blah, 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 and, you know, including sexuality on that list. Or also the idea of normalizing. So you might be evaluating a client who's just had a hip fracture or hip replacement, and you might say something like, you know, several of my clients who've had this surgery have questions about, you know, about how sex works after hip replacement. And if that's something that you're concerned about, we can certainly discuss that in a future session. Just kind of opening up that door and saying like, this can be on the table. Mm-hmm. And then limited information kind of goes like the next step. So now the client has indicated that they would like some more information. And so then we, as the therapist, provide them with maybe some broader general information, perhaps a handout. I commonly use the example of, say, giving someone a handout that illustrates various positions. And I've done this with clients a few times where I'll show it to them and I'll have them identify, you know, which of these is the man or the female, or depending on their role. And I really like one that is not just heteronormative, but that's another podcast probably. we'll get into resources separately. But basically looking at some, you know, diagrams and identifying, you know, which of these maintain hip precautions. Because I think, for example, it's easier to conceptualize 90 degrees in your hip like sitting in a chair. But if you're lying down or sideways or upside down, you know, where 90 degrees is gets a little bit less clear.
Students get hung up on that all the time when we do hip precautions. Because, yes, yeah, sometimes you change, you have a client in bed and it's like, wait, what's 90?
you think it's easy to kind of think about it like in a chair. But, you know, and you got to figure that the client themselves is probably not as familiar with hip precautions as we are. So it can be helpful for them to see like, oh, okay, that position would be okay. This one would not be okay. Mm-hmm. And I've done similar things with like spinal precautions or, and developing resources like that is another thing that's on my list. Cause there's really not enough of it. But limited information, I'm going to try to stick to the PLICIT model here, really refers to, sort of generalized, information, things that might be diagnosis specific versus like client specific, and often relates to things that are short term. So I'm using this example of hip fracture. So presumably this person has their hip replaced or they have their surgery. And once they've healed and things are more or less back to normal, they may not need, you know, sort of these adaptive strategies, but the limited information might provide resources for short term adaptations or whatnot, you know, pertaining to that situation. And then if at that point, either the person needs more or their situation kind of, you know, dictates that things be a little bit more client specific, that's what the specific suggestions refers to. So that might be, you know, taking a more detailed sexual history, doing some kind of like, intimacy or, you know, sexuality like inventory where you can get some more information. This might be a point where the partner is involved, if that's applicable, in trying to identify, you know, sort of client specific issues. Like, does this person need to find, you know, positions where their back pain is not exacerbated? Do they need strategies for energy conservation, you know, in the setting of chronic illness? And really trying to be more patient specific. And this could be something like having someone get on the mat in the gym and, you know, clothed and not in an intimate situation, but move around on the mat and figure out which positions are comfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, does using a wedge or a pillow, you know, alleviate that pressure? You know, or even having them do this, say, like in their bed in their room or in their bed in their room with their partner, you know, dressed, perhaps if the therapist is there, but, you know, kind of giving them a chance to kind of work out some of those challenges. And obviously this could also involve more like emotional and psychosocial stuff. But I was, you know, in general, I kind of come at it from a more biomechanical perspective, just given my background, which is acute rehab and geriatrics. But certainly depending on your clientele, the limited information and the specific suggestions could be more, you know, psychosocial in nature. And then the last part of the PLICIT model, the IT, that's the intensive therapy. So that's where we identify things that might be beyond our scope of practice. So this could be like, you know, a client is reporting pain to me, you know, during, say, an intimate situation, and I don't have you know, I don't have information in their, you know, in their medical history or whatever to explain that. It's not obvious why that pain might be occurring. So I may need to refer them, you know, say to medical to address that. Or, you know, there might be issues with, I suspect that maybe medication is interfering, but I obviously can't adjust medication. So then they need to be referred to their doctor. Or I might discover in the conversation that, you know, this might be more of a marriage issue than, you know, an issue related to your hip fracture. And so, you know, maybe that person needs to be referred, you know, to, you know, like a therapist, or it might be something where they need to seek like biofeedback for like a pelvic floor issue. And if I'm not, which I am not, I'd like to be, you know, qualified to do that sort of thing, then I would have to refer that to someone else. And it could even be just within the team. Like I've had therapists who I work with say to patients, I think it's great that you want to discuss this stuff, but I'm not really comfortable or qualified. I'm going to have Kate come see you.
Which is,
you know, and so that is an
important point. Yeah. And I think especially for students listening, don't feel bad if you're not the expert in everything. Like no OT.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And you're ethically speaking, if there's somebody else on your team or even in like the geographic area that knows more about it, you should be referring.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And right. And that's not necessarily, you know, speak negatively about that clinician. It's really about getting, you know, getting the client what they need. And yeah, so that idea of intensive and obviously we'll probably get to it when we speak about the other models, but that phrase intensive therapy, I think can be a little bit misleading because it doesn't necessarily mean that the person needs intensive therapy. It just means that they might need something from another clinician. And that might be another discipline, or like you said, it might just be another, it could just be a different occupational therapist,
right?
Or a different member of the team. You know, I've had nurses that I work with have clients talk to me because that particular nurse wasn't comfortable addressing it. And I think, yes, I think it makes sense to kind of know when something is not best aligned with your skill set and to bring someone else in.
It's interesting when you brought up that there might be an issue in the relationship itself. Because one of the articles I was reading to prepare for this was about applying the Plissett model for people with a stoma. And there was all these suggestions. And some of the suggestions were like, talk to your partner about sexual activity and make eye contact with your partner. And I'm thinking, well, these aren't stoma issues.
These are relationship issues.
Relationship issues. So that's a really good point.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, again, this is probably another, you know, another podcast, but I mean, lots of people who don't have disability or chronic illness have relationship and sexuality issues.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, obviously those, just like everything else, like for example, you know, maybe my eating habits aren't the best. Well, while I'm not in the hospital, that's not necessarily causing me a problem. But then some other thing comes up and I end up, you know, accessing healthcare services and now everything I do is under a microscope, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the same thing happens like, you know, with relationship issues or sexuality issues, people might just sort of be getting by and then you add an additional stressor or, you know, some other different.
You get an occupational therapy practitioner and they're asking you all sorts
of. Right. And then you're like, oh man, wow, this is worse than I thought.
All the stuff just comes out.
Yeah. But I mean, again, that's, you know, that's part of how we help to make it better is to identify, you know, where are the challenges. And again, going back to that permission part, you know, if you sort of open this door for people, some people, many people are going to take it. You know, and there are going to be some people that are going to be like, no, thank you. And you know, and I think, again, I'm sort of foreshadowing explicit, but you know, there's also this idea that this doesn't have to be a one and done.
But you know, that's so the idea of permission, we can kind of segue a little bit into the explicit, because that's the main difference. My takeaway with there's the Plissett model and the explicit model. And again, as we always do, we'll put all of this resources on our website. But the big thing with the explicit model is that permission should be at all levels and that it needs to be explicitly stated. Whereas now we might be kind of implicitly leading people, like not necessarily coming right and out and giving people permission to talk about sexual activity, that we need to really make sure people know that we can address that. And we need to keep reminding them of that.
Right. So and that can be, like, if someone says no the first time, it doesn't mean that they can't, you know, express interest later down the road. And that, you know, and it's interesting how the parallels when we talk about permission in terms of this model, and then also just in terms of like consent in general, it's like they kind of go very nicely together. Whereas like, just because I said I wanted to talk about this today doesn't necessarily mean that I have to continue it down the road. Mm-hmm. So you could also have somebody who kind of starts out wanting to address this in therapy, and then they're like, this is getting a little too, you know, either too uncomfortable or too close to an issue that I'm not really prepared to deal with. I don't want to continue down this road. And then we also have to respect that, you know, that can come in and out of the treatment plan at the patient's, you know, at the patient's say so.
And we have to understand that just because we, in our mind, gave permission early on, so maybe at the OT evaluation we're saying, we're explaining all the things that occupational therapy can address, and we say and sexual activity is one of those, that doesn't mean that that person heard us really the first time.
Yeah,
I mean, chances are they were caught up in a ton of other things that were going on at that time, so we really need to revisit and make sure that that clients understand that yes, we really can and we really will. Yes. Yeah.
And we're not going to judge you. We're not going to shame you. Nothing bad is going to happen.
Some examples. I'll read some of these of ways to give permission in some of the articles we were reading. One was kind of like I said, where you can open up with a statement. During occupational therapy, we focus on increasing your safety and independence during your daily activities, such as bathing, dressing, toileting, and sexual activity. I think that's usually my go-to starting point. But I don't. Many people are throwing in that sexual activity at the mm-hmm. end of that sentence.
Well, it sounds more like bathing, toileting, dressing, and so forth.
And that other thing.
And there were other duties as assigned.
Some more specific examples, like many clients with spinal cord injury report changes in their sexuality and intimacy. If you have any questions or concerns, let me know and we can explore. So really like getting specific with a diagnosis. This one, I have mixed feelings. I want to know your guys' thought on this example. This article is entitled Using the Extended Implicit Model to Address Sexual Healthcare Needs. And I think this one is targeted towards nurses. But here's the question they suggest.
Okay.
What happens when you and your partner try to make love? How would you, thank you. I wish everyone could see Kate's face. Right.
That probably wouldn't be my word choice. For a multitude of reasons. One, because I, mostly because make love still makes me cringy. Right? Maybe that's my own issue, but.
And again, not everyone has a partner, so it eliminates masturbation.
Right.
I find that.
Yeah, and I mean, that again is, that wouldn't be my word choice. Cause I think, right, first of all, that, right off the bat, that essentially kind of connects like your sexuality with like having a partner.
Somebody else. Yeah.
And I mean, one of the things that I am commonly presented with, I work primarily with a geriatric population, and I would say a large number of my clients don't have a partner. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, often because their partner is no longer living, you know, if they're, they may be separated from their partner. Like mm-hmm. It's not uncommon for me to have a patient with me at the hospital whose spouse is, you know, a long-term patient at a nursing home. And I think, I mean, obviously there's lots of things that we need to do in this area, but I think that idea of, you know, that sexuality has to be connected to a relationship is kind of a limiting idea.
Mm-hmm. Even bouncing off of that, like that making love term makes it sound like you're in, it, like, what about like one night stands?
Well, that's right. Like, what about if you don't love them?
There's shame in the statement. Like you're
A lot of my... A lot of my Catholic upbringing is coming to the surface. I think that would not be my word choice. But
no, I will say they do have another one, which again assumes that it's a couple. But I think this is a much better phrasing. How has your health affected you as a couple? How has it affected your sexual relationship? I think is a step closer
to that relationship.
If you know, yeah. But again, that's knowing that they're in a relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, I sometimes try to ask the relationship question first, because mm-hmm. that can give you a little bit of information about which way to go. Because yeah. the other side of this too is like, and this is one of the examples that I use sometimes when I present is, you know, the person being able to express sexuality or intimacy in their relationship doesn't necessarily have to be what we would think of as like sexual.
Yeah.
Like I had a patient probably about a year ago now. He was a gentleman probably in his 80s. He and his wife had been married for a million years. It happened that while he was with us, they were celebrating their anniversary. He had had a stroke. He had pretty limited movement in his right arm. And we were talking about, you know, goals and things that he wanted to work on. And one of the things that he told me was that he really wanted to be able to give his wife a hug.
Oh, I love it.
And like, I feel like that's an example of like how I, as a therapist, was able to help him like address what was not really like a sex goal, but was definitely an intimacy goal.
So and I think this is a
absolutely pertinent to his relationship.
Yeah.
And so I think that's another thing too that I try to convey when I'm talking to students and clinicians is that this doesn't all have to be like about like sexual positions and, you know, making love or whatever, you know, terminology you're using, but is like, how is this person able to connect with, you know, either their partner or just their primary relationships?
So this is a perfect segue to the recognition model, which I think all three of us are falling in love with.
Yeah, I heart the recognition model.
Let's let JJ introduce the recognition model.
All right.
So. I'm going to be very honest. There may be a little bit of bias on my end here, knowing that this model was developed by two occupational therapy professors and a physiotherapist. So, you know, it's coming from that's why it's so fantastic. But, you know, the first thing that they talk about with this model is we have to first recognize that people are sexual beings before we can even give them permission.
Yes. Amen.
We have to recognize
that. Our profession has an issue with. Yes. Society has an issue with. But I think we see a lot of people, especially cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, like we are not necessarily seeing these individuals as sexual.
And they're seen as being asexual. Yeah. And you see that in the literature. We can see it just in everyday life in society. And you know, this model, they even explicitly stated it here, that it's really about social justice and equality. And that's yes. kind of where we're at, which I love, and it's great, and yay! but the other
thing is, like, I feel like we are, like, sitting on a frontier of sorts.
Yep,
yeah.
With how a lot of this stuff is being looked at. And, yeah, I mean, that very beginning, and it's, you know, is that, you know, recognizing that, you know, humans are sexual beings, and that all humans, like regardless of, you know, body difference, regardless of illness or disability or age. And I think often what happens is it's an implicit bias of sorts where we see a yep. person in a wheelchair or we see a person that has, you know, some sort of like, you know, disfigurement or they're just old and we just assume, oh, they wouldn't be interested in that. They're not having concerns about sexuality.
Or they assume they can't do it. They like physically can't do it.
Yeah. Or that they wouldn't want to, which I think is an even worse assumption mm-hmm. because we are making a decision about what's important to that person without actually getting any of their input.
Which I think as a profession, we have a problem doing in many areas.
Yeah.
We make these assumptions, even if it's, we assume that being independent and toileting is a priority when it might not be a priority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's really true. I've had to have conversations with students about like, someone isn't maxicist for hygiene just because they don't meet your hygiene standard. Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Like, that's not the same thing. And right. I mean, where I work, we have a very large Portuguese population. And it's very common in that culture for women, particularly wives, to provide assistance to their husbands. And mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many male Portuguese clients I have had who do not have the least bit of interest in being able to put their own socks and shoes
on. Oh my gosh.
Because their wife will do it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
in the idea of like my husband being like, well, I don't need to do that, my wife will do it, like makes me want to, you know, fly off the handle. But that's me. That's yeah. not, that's because that's not culturally important or a priority for me. But I have to respect that if that's what works for them and that's part of their role and their ritual. And my going in there with a sock aid yeah. is actually kind of like, kind of insulting sometimes to that wife who feels like that's part of how she loves on him.
Yeah, when we make all these assumptions.
Right. And so, right. It's, that's not for me to make that assumption. It's for me to listen and what is it that's important to you and how do I help you get there? It's not right, about right. getting you to what's important to me. And then I think that gets amplified when we get into these sexuality topics for sure. Absolutely.
Oh yeah. And I think the other thing I really like about this model too, is that it really focuses on a team approach. So yes. all of this doesn't fall on one individual and that you know, that one person has to be the person to talk about sex. It is an entire team that includes, you know, nursing, OTs, PTs, speech therapists, physicians. So it's everybody, you know, talking about this subject. And the other thing too, you know, when they're talking about that recognition, they talk about being able to acknowledge, normalize, affirm, and validate sexuality with individuals. And part of that too, that acknowledgement is acknowledging that you may have your own limitations and you may not be the best person to help them in this area.
Amen to that.
Yeah, and that's okay. And then that kind of goes back. I mean, it's so interesting because I feel like this recognition model definitely brings to the table some stuff that Plissett, you know, is missing. But then there's obviously some parallels, you know, and that idea, like kind of what you just were saying, JJ, it really kind of is like parallels with the intensive therapy. It doesn't necessarily mean that like something intensive is needed. It just means like you need to know when you're not the person.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know?
And it's the same as other things. Like I have, you know, sometimes I'm like, I'm really struggling with this splint. I'm not great at this. I'm going to go ask, you know, this other therapist on my team who's really awesome at this, you know, to help with this splint. And that, you know, and it's kind of the same idea. We should be sort of using our, you know, using our strengths as the team. And I love the idea of making this stuff interdisciplinary. While I was reading this article, I was like, I'm going to do an in-service on my unit and everyone is going to be so annoyed with me. Because they're going to be like, no, Kate's going to make us all do it.
No,
I'll talk about it.
What we've learned, and I'm sure you learned, is everybody wants to talk about sex.
Oh yeah, everybody's favorite topic.
And as soon
whether
as,
or not they realize it or not, everyone wants to talk about
it. As soon as
it.
Kind of going to the Plissett, as soon as you give them permission, like as soon as we, I feel like we're giving practitioners permission to talk about it, and then all of a sudden everybody's like, okay,
yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and like you're saying to kind of, you know, it does kind of parallel some of the Plissett model. So after you recognize that someone is a sexual being, you know, then you give them that permission to discuss. And then further beyond that, then that step three is that exploration, which they kind of touch on that, like that's kind of where that Plissett model is missing. You know, they're not really exploring, well, what does this mean now? And then where do we take this? And just really
the actual kind, almost like the OT evaluation part, focusing on whatever is missing, whether it be the actual act, whether it be how to find a date, how to find a date, right? All those things.
Well, and just like, yeah, I kind of feel like that whole idea of exploration kind of really, it sort of like builds on that idea of limit. I feel like it takes the limited information and the specific suggestion and kind of like really sort of like broadens it a bit. Because yeah, you have to figure out, you know, well, what is it that this person really wants to work on? And how do I offer appropriate limited information or specific suggestions if I don't really know, you know, what the issues are?
Yeah.
And so then, yeah, that exploration thing, I was like, oh, that's great.
Right. Well, and I think, and I'm going to read right from the recognition model that I circled and put a big yes against. They were talking about limitations of the Plissett model, and they say the disabled people who collaborated in the development of the study reported they wanted to discuss much more than the mechanics of sex and the human mm-hmm. sexual response cycle. Their concerns included making and maintaining relationships, moving them towards intimacy, managing role changes between partners, or issues like fatigue or pain. And I think that's really, I really love that, moving them towards intimacy. I mean, that's huge. How do you go from meeting somebody online or wherever to an intimate relationship?
Right, right.
And especially, I mean, that's challenging for people who are able-bodied. Absolutely. And cognitively intact. So yeah. Certainly when you add, you know, other challenges to the mix, that gets more problematic. And again, like I was saying before, you know, sort of like jokingly, but I think it's true, is that a lot of those things that you just talked about, you know, are social skills that a lot of people struggle with, you know, not even necessarily within the realm of, you know, disability or chronic illness.
So you're going here. You're going here, Kate. Here's my question that I've been pondering lately.
Okay.
So again, in the United States, we've talked about this. We are through the American Occupational Therapy Association. We have the OT practice framework. And in that, we talk about approaches to therapy, one of which is creating and promoting. And that's a health promotion from the perspective that the person, the people we're working with, do not have disabilities. So here's my question. Is attaining sexual satisfaction and intimacy, satisfaction and intimacy, a public health issue?
I would have to say yes. I think absolutely. And I'm going to try to find it, because there was a great, I think it is actually in this article about the recognition model. I was doing the same thing. I was reading, my poor husband, I kept like pulling, I'm like, come here, listen, I want to read it with you. This is awesome. So at the beginning of the article about the recognition model, and I know you ladies said you're going to post this. So y'all that are listening, pull up these articles, because neither of them are terribly long, and there's some really cool stuff in here. But so the author quotes the World Health Organization's definitions of, or their working definition of sexuality, and then their definition of sexual health. And then the author's conclusion, you know, sort of after that says, thus sexual health is considerably more than the absence of disease and the prevention of unwanted pregnancy. It is closely allied to discourses of pleasure, self-esteem, intimate relationships, and connectedness. Sexual health is therefore integral to the quality of life and should be, and this is the part I love, should be reframed as strategies for fulfillment, rather than penis, vagina, anal penetration.
I'm doing a lot. Like,
strategies for fulfillment. I love that. Like, that to me is, I know that's like, right. That's fantastic.
Go ahead.
Oh, just going back to what you were saying about, you know, is it a public health issue? So at the very beginning of the article, they're talking about, something from the Department of Health, and it says, our sexual health affects our physical and psychological well-being and is central to some of the most important and lasting relationships in our lives. Mm-hmm. It follows that protecting, supporting, and restoring sexual health is important. And so I think when we talk about public health, like, you know, could you make an argument that at this day and age, like, relationship issues are a public health issue? I think you could.
Pretty easily.
You know, I think that, you know, we're, and it's interesting too, like we're talking about how like we met online, right? Well, meeting people and maintaining relationships through technology is a thing now, but it's still a new thing. And I think we're having to figure out how that works. And so I think that probably leads to, you know, some things going well and other things not going so well. but I think absolutely. And I think about just like, again, talking, I've used examples and talking about like limited information. I've had conversations with geriatric clients, who have some really strange ideas about, say, for example, how sexually transmitted diseases happen. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know, for example, like no one was having a conversation with my grandmother about chlamydia.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm pretty sure that, like, you know, many of the older adults that I work with have never really gotten any of that sort of information. And so, like, again, when we're talking about public health, you know,
to the senior centers and do some.
Well, yeah. And then also, you know, I think, you know, other things, and again, I, you know, not to be like too tangential, but I think some of the things that have come up recently with like the Me Too movement and mm-hmm. a lot of this stuff about, you know, where should the boundaries actually be? And how do we, you know, you know, exist as like sexual beings, but also like in a society where we treat each other with respect.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, I think there's a lot, maybe a lot of role for occupational therapy in, you know, working, you know, obviously it gets a little weird working with like children when we talk about like sexuality topics, but you know, how do we incorporate that sort of stuff into social skills and teaching yeah, people children, social like, skills?
What's appropriate? Who can see you naked? Who can't yeah. see you naked? Who?
Yeah. Or even just like, for example, one of the things that I do with my children are 12 and 10. And one of the things that we've talked about a lot in our house, and not necessarily in the context of sex, but in the context of play, is that like you can't roughhouse, for example, or wrestle, or you know, be aggressive in your play if both people are not okay with it.
Yeah.
Like if you're like tickling your sister or you're wrestling with your sister, like once she says, "Hey, stop, that's enough," you stop, that's enough. And it's interesting because I had a friend talk to me that like that's largely how she taught her children as they became teenagers about consent
yeah.
and about being able to communicate, you know, what they were comfortable with in sexual situations, is learning to, you know, to establish and then maintain boundaries in play.
Yeah.
Right. And we as therapists talk a lot about, you know, and I don't work in pediatrics, but I know a lot of like pediatric OTs, you know, we look at like play is occupation for children. Yeah. And it's the foundation for learning occupation as an adult. You know, and so, but again, like we do some really weird stuff in this country about teaching children about sex.
Sure do.
Yes. Yep.
Like I often use the example of like, you know, you have a baby and it's, you know, back to sleep, back to sleep, back to sleep. And then, you know, seatbelts, car seats and bike helmets. And, you know, and we hammer all of these like safety issues when our kids are young, and we plug up all the electrical outlets and, you know, and then like they get to be like an age where they're starting to become like sexual beings, and we don't give them any information. We don't teach them how to be safe. You know, right? Like we don't necessarily teach them like the language to use. I have a friend, she teaches high school, and she had a male student bring up in a classroom discussion the idea that, you know, people tell us all the time, like, you know, what no looks like. He's like, but I don't really know what yes looks like.
Oh, I like that. That's
it,
yeah.
And I was like, that's so true. Is like, we really you know, I think some of that public health issue that you talk about is in our, like in the social part. And how do we convey consent? How do we, you know, how do we express ourselves and either what we want or what we're not comfortable with, mm-hmm. and breaking down some of the idea that we can't talk about that stuff. Of course we should.
Yeah.
Those are the conversations that should be happening first.
Teaching people how to talk about what they do enjoy. all of that. Like I'm reading a great, JJ has been hearing me talk about yes. it so much. I'm reading a great book. I highly recommend it to everyone. Called Becoming Clitorate.
Ooh, I like that.
Really great book.
I'm adding it to my list.
It was one of the most recent chapters I was reading was talking about just in general. We don't even teach the right terminology. We call women call everything down there the vagina.
Right.
Yeah.
There's several different parts down there.
And sometimes misinformation about that. We don't. Again, we teach all these other things, but then when we know that there's a natural progression to start masturbating, no one's talking about it. No one is telling young girls like that they have a clitoris and that
right.
And that like you can touch it and it feels good, and that's okay.
Good. Yeah.
Well, even just that whole idea of pleasure. Like, I think for a long time, like, particularly female pleasure has been a total back burner.
Oh, yeah. You really need to read the book. Yeah. Because a lot of it is about that. It's about how there's a lack of orgasm equality. And it's all focused yep. on the male orgasm and not the female. And it even talks about, and we mentioned this on a previous podcast, the history of the vibrator came from a time when women weren't having orgasms for various reasons I won't get into. And then they were having what was called hysteria. Psychological and physical effects, and doctors were having to, as it described in the book in Becoming Clitorate, a couple of fingers went in the vagina and then another hand pressed down on the clitoris and rubbed. And then women kept coming back for this treatment, and then they had to invent the vibrator.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I'm a little disappointed that no doctor has ever offered me that service. I'm feeling a little bit, you know, it's interesting too, like there's so much you could unpack there about like equating like hysteria and like because like, you know, where, you know, a woman with needs is hysterical, where like, you know, a man with needs is just a man.
Yeah, right. That's another whole episode. Yeah. That's all other podcasts. Right. Like,
and I don't know if she gets into it in that part, but I know that like one of the first vibrators was like coal powered. So you had to like, you had to basically like light it on fire and get the coal to be hot.
To light yourself on fire.
That's interesting.
And I was like, wow, I'm like, that's dangerous.
The last thing I read in it when I was reading it yesterday was that the vibrator was the fifth electrified appliance. It was the fifth appliance we had like behind the toaster.
We plugged in.
And then vibrator was number five. Yeah.
Which, I mean, if you think about it, makes a lot of sense. I mean, if I had to pick my top five appliances in my house, I mean, the washing machine is probably still number one, but.
Let me see. I have the book here. I'm going to see if I can find what the top five were real quick. Where is it? The vibrator was the fifth appliance to be electrified after the sewing machine, fan, tea kettle, and the toaster. But before the iron and the skillet.
Yeah. And obviously before,
I would want to iron. I'd rather get off before I want to iron.
I don't care if my pants are wrinkled. Right. Oh, that's hilarious. Well, and I think that kind of goes to show that like this isn't really new.
No.
Like I think, you know, people want to sort of buy into this idea that this is like a new thing. And I'm like, it's not really a new thing. We're breaking down some of the barriers to like having the conversation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And really that has probably been, you know, I think like, you know, have I like taught a lot of people like the specifics of the Plissett model? Maybe, maybe not. But I definitely think what I have done over the last few years is started to like, you know, chip away at some of the barriers to these conversations. And I think the way that this whole thing gets better and the way that it becomes more comfortable for therapists and becomes more comfortable for clients is just by having the conversations. Like the more we talk about it, the less weird it is to talk about.
I think that's like a perfect closing statement.
Right?
I mean, just, have the conversation. Yeah. This was great, ladies.
Wow. Thank you so much, Kate, for being on. Yes. We really, really appreciate it and all your insights and your expertise regarding the Plissett model and OT practice.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. And I've enjoyed listening to your stuff and I look forward to more of it. And maybe we'll get to work on some kind of a project together in the future. That'd be awesome.
My ideas.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We want to thank Kate Burke for being on OT After Dark today. We had a blast talking with her about all of these different models. You can find her on Instagram at OTKate.
As usual, you can find all of the materials we referenced on OTAfterDark.com.
We are so excited to be back and hope you are just as thrilled. And thanks for coming today.
We hope we filled that gaping hole. You know who you are. Don't forget, sex is an ADL.
Cheers!